I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs. Now, here's the host of Our House, Peter Hunt.
Good morning and welcome to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the continuously improving huntrealestate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and homeownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA here in Buffalo, Niagara, and all across upstate New York, and also through our links to Boston, Massachusetts, and Phoenix, Arizona. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, NMLS number 37405. Hunt Mortgage is proudly an equal opportunity lender. Call them today, 633-3700, and ask one of our very skilled mortgage consultants to work with you to find the lowest rate and closing costs for your particular home financing needs and wants, and that's our guarantee. Or you can simply go to Hunt Real Estate, huntmortgage.com. Also ask about or research online our many exclusive programs, including our unique pre-purchase commitment that allows you at no cost or risk to effectively enter the market to find your next home with cash. In today's very competitive residential real estate market, where there is still a shortage of listings, believe it or not, when you find the house you want to make sure that your offer is as strong as possible when there's still often more than one offer. From a seller's perspective, cash is very persuasive. Working with a skilled Hunt sales professional armed with your pre-purchase commitment, your offer is the equivalent of cash, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. And you may find yourself now in a house that was right for you when you bought it years ago, but you've outgrown it, or maybe it's outgrown you. In any case, it no longer meets your lifestyle. But where will you go, even if you were able to sell it for a great price? Hunt Mortgage and your Hunt sales professional can help solve that problem through the Golden Gate, the bridge to your next home, a unique bridge loan program that unlocks the equity in your present house to get you out looking for the right house for you right now. To learn more about any of our unique programs, go to huntmortgage.com or call Hunt Mortgage today at 716-633-3700 for personalized, customized service that will knock your socks off. Hunt is the official real estate and relocation provider, our hometown professional teams, the Buffalo Bills and the Buffalo Sabres, and Sabres are hot and Bills are out, unfortunately. And we're also very proud supporters of our Buffalo Bisons and the Buffalo Bandits, who we are always glad to see here at home. Our house is broadcast live on WBEN 930 AM and 98.5 FM HD3. You can listen anywhere in the world through the Odyssey app or WBEN.com. And for those of you who'd like to participate in today's show, if you have any questions or comments about any aspect of real estate, you can call or text us. It's the same number, 716-803-0930. If you're long distance, 1-800-616-9236. And if you're mobile, *930. Those are all free calls. Join us on the air at Our House. We have a very special show for you today. Live in the studio with me today is Chris Jacobs. Mr. Jacobs is formerly a United States Congressman from here in Western New York, and also a developer, Avalon Development. Is that still the
correct
name?
Yes.
Good morning, Chris.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
And well, it's great to have you here. You've been one of my long-time guests here on the show in your various iterations. I was thinking about this as I was driving over here today. I think you may be the only person in the world who has succeeded our current governor in two different positions.
That's true. That's really true. Yeah.
And I've interviewed each step along the way, which has been kind of interesting. Do you have any intention of succeeding our guy?
No, it's funny because the whole Chris Collins, Kathy Hochul kind of, because she won in Congress, and that opened up an opportunity to run for clerk, and then And then Collins lost that year, surprisingly, a county executive to Mark Pullenkars. And then he, in turn, beat Kathy Hochul the next time around in Congress. It was new district lines. And then Kathy, you know, is a year in here back home, and then gets tapped to go to Albany, and you know, so yeah, it that's why politics is very hard to plan out. Opportunities arrive, and you kind of seize them if they're the right opportunity for you.
Well, you know, I've known your family for a long time, and it's interesting to see how someone with your family background would even want to enter the political world. Has that always been an ambition of yours, or were you drafted?
No, I don't think drafted. I definitely had an interest in public service. I thought early on, and my parents were always very involved in community activities. My father was a physician, and I remember him asking me when I was in college what I wanted to do with my life. And I said, well, Dad, you know my science grades, so you know being a doctor is out of the question. But I said, like you, I would like to find something where I wake up every day excited about what I do and that I'm able to help people. So that's really what started my path on trying to find something. And that certainly can be achieved. I've been very involved in the charitable world, the Bison Scholarship Fund, which is a program I started. So it's certainly not only in elected office, but it was really when I started the Bison Fund in 1994, which is a scholarship fund. We raise private donations to empower low-income families with having the ability to choose a school that's best for their families, religious, value-based schools or non, but have choice and not be stuck in a monopoly. But that out of that was really what got me interested in I morphed into getting involved in this the charter school movement. I helped start a charter school in South Buffalo, and out of that became much more aware of the failings of the Buffalo Public Schools. And I said, you know, to myself, thinking through this, I said, well, I'm really proud that at the Bison Fund we were helping 500 kids. Now we're helping about almost 3,000 children a year. But very proud of what we've achieved there. Very proud of charter school, but there's still 35,000 kids that are in a system that's really not satisfying most of their needs. And so I decided to run for school board. That was really my first entree into politics. And I've always said that people view that as, you know, the lowest level of elected office. I'm as proud to represent Buffalonians in the school board as I was in Congress. But also, it really was democracy at work, where you are at a table, sitting across the table for hours at end with people who you disagree with on many issues, and you are forced, you really have the opportunity to have dialogue and debate. You don't see that as much sometimes as you move upstream. You see people talking on TV in a chamber, but if they pan the chamber, it would be empty. They're just doing their talking points, and the other person is doing their talking points, and never the twain shall meet. So that was one thing I thought was great. And you know what? I think many of the people that when I ran on school board that maybe I ran against, and you know, running against somebody's tough, after 3 or 4 years of serving on a board together and spending countless hours, we became to agree on more than we disagreed. And I learned, I believe, a lot from them on their perspective and their worldview, and hopefully they gained some from me. And I consider most of the people that I served with on the school board for the 7 years I did friends. And and really, actually, that was funny how that connects. That deep friendship that I had with a lot of those members, most of them African American, I was really why the top shooting profoundly impacted me, because I knew a person that perished there, but more so, a lot of my long term friends on the school board I talked to, and the way they were suffering on that, because they knew, had relatives and friends and.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Chris, that you bring that up, because as we look back on, I mean, I hate to even draw the comparison, but as we look back on the loss of the Bills on Sunday, mm-hmm. there was so much chatter about the impact of things like the TOPS shootings that impacted the players in such a profound way that it just, you know, they were spent by the time mm-hmm. we got to the playoffs. I don't know if that's a rationalization or what it is, but I would like to believe that they're professionals, and as such, I guess there's always going to be hardships or tragedies around you in any community. In a city our size, you expect it less, I guess. And when something like that happens, it gets worldwide attention, along with what happened to Damar Hamlin. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's two serious blows to our psyche, really, as much as anything else. But let's go back to the school issue, because I've interviewed each of the superintendents, except our current superintendent of the Buffalo schools. And particularly during the pandemic, it was a crushing blow to so many young people across the country, really, across the world, that how did you look at it? You were in Congress at the time. How did you look at the school situation? Was it different, or was it just a pause, or what happened? Because I couldn't help but visualize young people sitting at home, parents maybe working, maybe not working, particularly if they're essential workers in a hospital or something like that, and they're, what are these kids going to do? I mean, they might get an assignment somehow, mm-hmm. and they're looking at a computer maybe if there was one available in their home. But, I mean, it seems like that period of time just totally exacerbated the problems that we face in every school system.
Yeah, it was interesting. There's a program that has been around for a long time called the Close-Up. It's the Close-Up Foundation, and they I don't know all what they do, but they basically bring cohorts of kids down to Washington for a week, high school kids, and they have sessions on issues and probably have speakers come to them, but they also come up to Capitol Hill and meet with their members of Congress and really impressive young people. And I've had the opportunity a couple times to have them come before me, and I took them on a tour and spoke to them in front of the Capitol. But the one time, about a year and a half ago, I was sitting with them and said, you know, let me ask you guys something. You have all been through a historic thing with COVID and with the lockdown of schools and with remote learning. How has that been? And so they, you know, how did you deal with that? And so some of them had a positive spin. Well, you know, I had more flexibility, and you know, but we did this and we did that. And then one young man said to me, he said, you know, we're here because we're really good students. we got chosen to come to this special program. And so, you know, we found a way to make it work. But he said, friends of mine who are not great students, who really needed help, who need a teacher to their side to help them along, they just languished at home. And when we had this model of the hybrid where it was 2 days on, 2 days off or whatever, my friends that were in that boat that I described, they just were home doing nothing, absolutely nothing. And that was a long time. You know, that was, these kids were from a more rural area. So, you know, I was very outspoken that I thought the lockdowns were excessive in terms of our children, and that I think one thing it showed is big city teachers unions don't put the children first. And we just saw that over and over again, and I would put our union head in the city of Buffalo in the same vein, that he used every excuse under the sun not to get his teachers back in the school.
Well, that illustrates the political nature of the whole lockdown experience that we all went through. I mean, just in our industry, we were deemed essential one day, literally the next day we were deemed non-essential, and then the third day we were deemed essential again. So in the meantime, we opened up, locked down, and opened up again. And in the meantime, we had to do everything humanly possible to make the offices someplace that somebody would want to come to, mm-hmm. including HVAC, making sure the air quality was such that it was acceptable to the new standards. In addition to that, we had to make sure it was super clean. We were doubled up on all our cleaning. It was a very, very expensive proposition. And still, people used that whole experience to set up an office at home, and it's changed the whole nature, really, of the work environment. And I guess one of the things that concerns me, in addition, obviously, to the effect on a, say a 12-year-old kid, when it was 12-year-old when this whole thing started, 2 years of the lack of socialization, mm-hmm. sports, just being able to see your friends, what do you do with yourself at home all day? 2 years of that. I mean, to me, there had to be some scientific justification. When you were in Congress, what did they say? Did they say that here's all the science? I mean, we heard it every day on these news conferences, but I heard very little science.
No, yeah, it's right. It's selective. You know, use the science when it meets your goal. But on this one, there was not a compelling argument that we, you know, pretty consistent that children were the least likely to get it, that they transmit it. Instances of it were usually not acquired in the school. They were outside the school. Arguably, you could make the argument that it was more dangerous because you're putting these kids back home around older people, more vulnerable people. So I think that the science was not good, and we have, you know, 2 years of learning loss, but that has been exacerbated as far as how far back these kids are. And then it's exacerbated when you're talking about a poverty-stricken rural community or in a city of Buffalo. And, you know, I was at a meeting the other day on this issue of the problem of the busing. And we have a situation right now with our kids not being able to get to school in time or having to leave early. So in the year we need to be doing massive catch-up, these kids are not even in school now as much as they need to be. So we have a real issue here. And I agree with you, socialization, having young children, you see kids even preschool, before school age, which I have some, that how they try, they interact in a playground. They don't know how to do that. And so these are profound issues. And, you know, we always learn when we're I learned in the school board, you know, that those early 1 to 6 years old are the building blocks, oral language skills, learning facial expressions. Those are the things that happen before you learn to read. But if you don't have those building blocks, reading is going to be that much harder to attain.
There has been a lot of talk about how masks, a little child wearing a mask, how they learn, just like you're saying, facial expressions.
Exactly.
and just how you form a word, mm-hmm. and the effect that it's having right now on speech.
Yes.
And these poor kids are having a terrible time.
It's almost mirroring what autistic children have, where they don't pick up those facial cues. Well, now you're creating it with a non-autistic kid. So these are big issues.
They're huge issues. You know, I was thinking as you were talking about how your father would have looked at this situation. I can't imagine that a man of that depth of science and study and research, how he wouldn't have been terribly outspoken about this. I just can't imagine people of that.
Well, I do think he would not be, and I've been supportive of the telemedicine concept. He would, I know, not be for that, because he believed you needed to look your patient in the eye, you needed to touch your, you know, you needed, so I think he would not be a big advocate of that.
Well, he's famous for his bedside manner.
Yeah.
Humor, for sure. Anyway, the bottom line on all this, and I want to shift gears a little bit, the bottom line is that the poorest people in our society always suffer the most from everything.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever there's a problem, they get it worse. Mm-hmm. And right now, all that we went through is now compounded with the whole economic situation. You were in Congress at the time as all this was unfolding. What was the sentiment in Congress on both sides of the aisle in terms of how we got to a situation where really we're looking at the Fed and saying, you guys fix this mess, because – and now they're going to meet again next week.
Mm-hmm.
And the prediction is that maybe 25 basis points or 50 basis points, it's a quarter or half a percent more, which means that all businesses will pay more. And everyone at the supermarket is going to pay more in one way, shape, or form. So again, it trickles down very negatively to, again, the poorest people in our society. What was the conversation like in Congress?
Well, I think that what we're finding here is, I would, you know, give kudos to the Republican side who fought against what we felt to be outrageously reckless spending. is that there's no free lunches. So we, you know, we threw money out that outside the Capitol door to everybody, and you know, we knew, you know, I came in a special election, so I had a little bit of the Trump time where we had every one of the stimulus packages during the Trump era was bipartisan. But then when Joe Biden came in, there was another, I think it was $1.9 trillion stimulus. And all the indicators we saw is that the economy was coming back on its own. We had stimulated enough, maybe even too much then, you know, in retrospect. But that such a small percentage of that stimulus of $1.9 trillion had anything to do with COVID. It was very small. It was like 10 or 15%. The rest of it was just a boondoggle of everything under the sun. And also a lot of incentives to stay back at home. And we wanted to get people back to work. So what we see now is all that money went out the door and it incentive, you know, a shocker, you pay people more to stay at home. They stayed home and it ginned up inflation. And now we're paying it back up. We are having to pay it back again through interest rates and maybe ramming the economy into a recession. So it's unfortunate that they just seem to take this opportunity. And I mean, I cannot, somebody will say, what are the things you're most proud of legislatively? I said, unfortunately, it's what we blocked. But, you know, that Build Back Better, thank God for Joe Manchin that stopped that Build Back Better, which was, I can't remember what it was. It was like $4.5 trillion, biggest single expenditure ever. But the element of it that was even more pronounced was entirely new entitlement programs. So, you know, as Ronald Reagan says, the closest thing to eternal life is a new federal program. They would never have gone away. So it was far more than $4.5 trillion. I mean, it was the movement towards socialism. That's really what was the goal. The left of the Democratic Party is pushing that. But, you know, on and on and on. More money, printing more money. And that was really the first 2 years of this Biden administration. And, you know, we're seeing what it's done to the economy.
It was so interesting to watch all that. Sadly interesting, because in my lifetime, and perhaps you saw it firsthand, I've never seen a more purely divided government, mm-hmm. in terms of either you were black or you were white. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't anything in between. It seemed to be no moderation. What were the discussions like across the aisle? Was there any discussion, or was it just this block is going to vote this way and this block's going to vote that way?
Yeah. I wish I had had a longer tenure in Congress. I'd have a better perspective. When I first got in, met some outgoing members, long-term members, who said it's just not the same as it used to be. It's more, much more collegial, much more bipartisan. And we have a very polarized nation right now, and we're, I guess, representative of that. But it seems like the kind of extreme elements of either party are very dictating the agenda. And you've seen a lot of the Democratic members who have lurched left. You know, I go back and find quotes of Chuck Schumer in defense of the wall, the southern wall. But now it's a terrible thing to talk about securing the border. So those sort of things you've seen them go to the outward extremes, and that's made it much harder bring together, you know, bipartisan dialogue. But, you know, as we talked before we came, those battles, those high-level things always get all the attention. There is still a lot of important work going on. There should be more, but there is still, and there's a lot of good-hearted people who are in the trenches trying to work on things. And you know, I could cite a lot of things we did get done on a bipartisan basis.
Well, that'd be good to know, because I think the general public knows very little mm-hmm. about that. And I don't mean to harp on the past in terms of your other experience. I do want to talk about what you're coming into yeah. now, or coming back to, I guess, here in Buffalo, which I think is a great asset for us to have a gentleman like you busy at work here in our town. We have to go to a break in just a second here, but when we come back, I'd like to kind of have you put a punctuation point on your congressional experience, and then turn to how you see our real estate function, the portion of real estate our economy that's based in real estate, how you see that evolving here in Buffalo as we go forward. And we'll be right back with more from Our House to Yours after these very important messages.
Buying a home can be challenging, especially if you need to sell your current house first. Hunt Mortgage and Hunt Real Estate are here to help with the Golden Gate, the bridge to your next home. This innovative program features a bridge loan from Hunt Mortgage along with a guaranteed sale of your current home when you partner with a Hunt Real Estate sales professional. Visit huntmortgage.com/Golden Gate for more details. The Golden Gate from Hunt Mortgage and Hunt Real Estate. Your equity when you want it, your home sold guaranteed. Terms and conditions apply. Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, NMLS 37405, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the continuously improving huntrealestate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and homeownership experience. Huntrealestate.com is the only place on the web where you can find not only a complete set of homes available in markets we serve, but you're also going to find access to a complete array of homeownership services at huntrealestate.com, which is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA. This show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, and for more information about our exclusive mortgage program that is your assurance of the lowest rate and closing costs, what we call the Second Look Program, call today 716-633-3700 or go to huntmortgage.com and look for those details. If you watch television at all or look at incoming messages on your tablet or phone, you're inundated with mortgage offerings, particularly to refinance your current loan. How are you going to know if you're getting the very best deal? Well, let us take a second look through Hunt Mortgage's Second Look program. There is no cost or risk, and we're so convinced this will help you, you're going to get a gift certificate just for allowing us to take that second look at whatever you've received from any other lender. Also ask about our pre-purchase commitment and the Golden Gate, the Bridge to Your Next Home, or even the Cash Guarantee Letter, a very interesting program, only at Hunt Mortgage, 716-633-3700 or huntmortgage.com. I'm live in the studio today with a very special guest, Chris Jacobs, who is the former congressman. What was your district?
27th.
That kind of morphed, didn't it?
It did. Well, it vanished because we, in when the census comes out every 10 years, we lost a congressional district. So 27th was the last number, you know, so we're now only of 26. So.
Really?
But it did. It did change. A part of it went Erie. My district went from Erie and Niagara east towards the outskirts of Rochester. Now it got split. Claudia Tenney picked up a lot of that area. Nick Langworthy picked up the Erie County portion, and then goes down into the southern tier and all those counties: Cattaraugus, Chautauqua, Allegheny, along the Pennsylvania border.
And Brian Higgins is the city, pretty much.
Brian's didn't change a lot. It didn't change a lot.
We have a caller in line. This is Jack from Buffalo. Jack, how can we help you?
Good morning, gentlemen. I just wanted to put myself demographically. My wife was a good friend of the congressman's mother. So that generation. I wanted to say that there is a book by Robert Zubrin called Merchants of Despair, which generates information about how this whole movement of wokeism and environmentalism got started, how it went through the couple of centuries, and came to reach us in the present, and it is a must reading for everyone. It's not a mystery. The players involved are outlined, how they got where they got, what the response of the politicians have been over the years. We can get out of this, but it's going to take a major effort, and it's got to start with the schools. Critical thinking has to be returned, and I would urge everyone, you gentlemen included, to make it your business to get Merchants of Despair by Robert Zubrin. He, you may recognize the name, he's in the forefront of the mission to Mars, by the way. So he's a well-learned gentleman. His background is, I believe, in nuclear physics. You can catch him on YouTube as well, and I wanted to get that into the conversation, and especially with regard to climate. What a mistake that has been. And I'm very happy to say the congressman helped our group, which was Citizens Against Wind Turbines in Lake Erie. We did achieve a victory there, and we want to thank him for his part.
Thank you, Jack. Yeah, you know, I think that one positive of one of the few positives I saw out of the COVID period and the lockdowns and remote learning was that parents got a glimmer of what was going on in the classroom, And they had a lot, you know, just assumed it was pretty much what they had experienced. And then I think they found out that wasn't a case. It was often infused with a lot of political messaging. And I think what it's caused is a whole new movement of parents getting much more involved in the what's going on in the education realm, whether it be running for school board, attending school board meetings, holding people accountable. And that is really important because it is critically important what goes on in that classroom at the early grades. We've always talked about the political slant at the university level, which is, you know, we all know is the truth, but it's gone down into the high school level and even sometimes the grammar school level. So we need to fight to make sure the fundamentals are being taught, as you said, Jack, critical thinking, so our kids come out prepared and also come out inquisitive about both sides of an argument and not just bought into one.
Interestingly, there's a lot of discussion also in the educational world about preparing people for jobs. We have and the reindustrialization of our United States economy. In order to really reindustrialize, we need people, skilled workers, at all levels of the manufacturing spectrum. And there's just not enough of those people, obviously. And we have really a kind of a very interesting thing going on in terms of employment, as I'm sure you've noticed. We have a very low unemployment rate. We have something like 10.5 million open jobs in this country. Yet we have financial institutions almost across the board laying people off. How do you view all that? I mean, you must study that.
It is a really tricky thing to look at. You know, when you look at
particularly as it relates to education, because you know we've had years and years of pushing liberal education, and now we liberal arts kind of education. Now we've got a real need exactly in the opposite direction.
Yeah. And it just, you know, when people early on were coming out of COVID said, oh, things are good. The unemployment rate is at this rate is very low. But then you look at the worker participation rate was at record low, meaning there was still so many people sitting on the sidelines not actively looking. And I think there's been some good articles written by Robinson who from the Buffalo News talking about our unemployment rate is low, but the dramatic amount of people less in the workforce, our workforce, than pre-COVID, and that we are – so the lack of ability to get employees has dragged our economy down, our ability to grow. So basically it's kind of like the manufacturer saying, I can't take that opportunity to do that project for a new vendor because I don't have the workforce. So it's really a drain. And we have a huge issue in terms of people, workforce. Right? I mean, we have, I think, a lot of people who retired out of COVID who would have stayed a few more years in the workforce. And so it's a big challenge in terms of where are we going to get these workers. But your point is well taken, that they have the misalignments of skills or the lack of skills. And that I think we're starting to talk a little more differently than we were 10 years ago on saying vocational trades are a great professional and actually often can be more earning-wise better than a lot of other things that might be quote-unquote white-collar. So I hope people are really taking that because I think that there's a lot of people who would thrive with those kind of jobs.
And the direct impact on real estate of what you're saying is huge. Next week, Stephen Tucker from the Northland Workforce Development Center is going to be on. And
which is a very impressive place.
Extremely impressive. But even at peak performance, they're putting maybe 400 people out at a time in terms of the program. We'll hear more about it next week. And he's been on a few times already just because I'm fascinated with what's going on over there. I've been over there several times. It's an amazing place, but it's one place. And there's been an enormous amount invested, as you know, from the state level. I think you were in the Senate at the time mm-hmm. when all this was passed. What was that like? I mean, how do we pick a program like that when you as a state senator? And how do we really kind of match a program like that with needs of the
Well, economy? I think that I believe that was part of the Buffalo Billion, which I think part of it was before I was there. But that was a weird animal. That was kind of, you know, New York does things in certain ways where they create these pots of money and then give an immense amount of discretion on where it goes. And the governor at the time, Cuomo, was a master in that, and he doled that out the way he wanted. And I thought Northland was a home run, but there was a lot of other non-home runs and waste of money, I thought, that had happened, like the rest stop in Grand Island, which was $20 million for, you know, and it's virtually empty all the time, just because they wanted to say they did something. So, but Northland is good, and I think that, that's a great model that should be replicated.
Northland is an amazing site. As you know, this state poured something close to $2 billion into the buildings, the public school buildings in the city of Buffalo over a period of years. And during that time, of course, one of the promises was, and I've interviewed people several times about this, that the area around these schools would also, there'd be an investment from the developer in the area around these schools. That's almost non-existent, as you know.
Right.
And one of the great hopes, I think, with Northland and other projects like that is that there will be the impact will radiate out from that site. People need to live someplace if they can live close to where they're going to school or go to work. This is something that is natural, and we would like to see that happen, but it really hasn't happened here. You're an investor in properties in the city, residential for the most part, or redeveloped into residential. How do you gauge the demand for something that you do along lines of what's going on around the project that you do?
Yeah, I just on the school issue, you know, I was on the school board when we did. I was good. The entire time I was there, the joint school construction was going on, and I sat on the board. And there was a promise and hope that there would be more investment and coordination around the area of the buildings. And that did not happen. I also think that I'm a big advocate for neighborhood schools. And I believe that when you are we are still dealing, and I'm a little out of date because I haven't been on the school board in a while, but you know that we were still dealing with the remnants of desegregation and busing. And we had a lot of kids. I remember I was very involved with returning North Park Academy, School 66 in North Buffalo, back to a neighborhood school. And when we were looking into that school, right in the heart of North Buffalo, I think out of the couple hundred kids that were at that school, two kids walked. Everyone else was bused, and they were bused from far away. And so the school was dormant at night. There was no activities at night because the kids were on the other side of town. You see that school now where the majority, a high percentage of those kids walk to school. They are involved in after-hour programming, Saturday programming. So that's the way I believe that you get the vibrancy, the maximum vibrancy of a school in a neighborhood. So I really hope we get back to that. And I hope that this, you know, this busing crisis shows that we need to do this because we just can't do the busing model where you take a kid for 45 minutes one way and 45 minutes the other. And, you know, they go in the wintertime, it's night, dark in the morning, and dark at night, and they can't. So that's I think, we need to get to because I think it's very important for the academics and also the neighborhood.
What you're touching on in terms of the building itself being a center for the social socialization of the community is really critical. We've talked about that a lot with David Rust, for example, from Say Yes Buffalo here on this show. And I was on that board for quite a while, and it was wonderful to see how the transition during the early years of Say Yes from these schools, like you say, remaining dormant for so much of the time that the building existed, to a point where there's after-school programs, Saturday programs, and they really, a school should be the cultural center of a socialization, the whole process that goes on in a community. What better place would there be?
Right.
I mean, really.
Exactly.
We have to go to a break. We'll be right back with more from our upstairs after these messages.
Buying a home can be challenging, especially if you need to sell your current house first. Hunt Mortgage and Hunt Real Estate are here to help with the Golden Gate, the bridge to your next home. This innovative program features a bridge loan from Hunt Mortgage along with a guaranteed sale of your current home when you partner with a Hunt Real Estate sales professional. Visit huntmortgage.com/Golden Gate for more details. The Golden Gate from Hunt Mortgage and Hunt Real Estate. Your equity when you want it, your home sold guaranteed. Terms and conditions apply. Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, NMLS 37405, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the continuously improving HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and homeownership experience. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage and HuntMortgage.com, NMLS number 37405, and Hunt Mortgage is an equal opportunity lender. I'm here in the studio today with Chris Jacobs, the former congressman from the then 27th District of the United States, of New York State, in the United States Congress. We've been talking about, I guess we're kind of meandering from topic to topic here, but you have so much experience in so many key elements of our community, Chris, that I don't know if there's someone who has that kind of depth experience besides you. Going back to, as we were talking about before, the whole redevelopment of the schools when you're on the school board, to the your involvement even before that with the Bison Fund. And I don't think, you mentioned that, but I don't think people really, I think they need to understand the depth of that kind of experience and how much impact that's had. As you said, 3,000 students now are involved in that program, which is huge. And my compliments to you for all you did for that. Part of that really is, in my mind as I watched that, was really a response to the lack of school choice here in our community. Charter schools were, again, mm-hmm. a response to a lack of school choice. Do you ever see a point in time when here in our community, or I guess better yet in New York State, where people would be given the choice, really given the choice, and able to move from a school with very low performance indicators to another school, or be given an allocation of dollars to go to private school, yeah. for example?
You know, when I started the Bison Fund in 1994, I was in Washington at the time, and I moved back home to start it, and I kind of ran the program for the first couple years. And the way the Bison Fund was structured at that time, we raised money, we had a lottery, and the parent that got the a voucher would then have a period of time where they could, for the first time, be a consumer and go around and interview different schools for their kids, empowering the parent for mm-hmm. first time, not being told where they're going to go. And but at that time, the way we worked is, it was a 50-50 deal. We pay 50% of the cost of the tuition. They would pay 50% of the cost. And the first 2 weeks that we announced the Bison Fund, I had 300 applications for families. And that, to me, to say these were all low-income families from the city of Buffalo. We've expanded now into the eight counties, but we at that point we were just the city of Buffalo. That things were so bad, what their kids were getting, that these people were willing to find a way to fork out 50% of the cost of private school if we do 50. So that to me said there's a real problem here. And that was really my mantra and other founders of Bison, that we want to help those that are in that position. And that's why we were committed to continue to grow it. And then the charter school movement, I felt, was another avenue to do that. That it was a, you know, one school, one board on that school. It wasn't a big bureaucracy. We were able to adjust and adapt and address the needs of kids. But unfortunately, one reason I got interested in running for the school board is at that point in time, there was a good group of people on the school board who were saying, you know, charter schools are here. As opposed to complaining about them, let's work with them and use them and actually create some of our own district charter schools who may be able to be a little more nimble and address needs that we are not, our big system, able to deal with, like alternative for troubled children, immigrant children, etc. So I said, that is great. I want to be in on that. So I ran and I got elected. And then Philbert Moore and the teachers union just took out almost every member that wanted to do that and crushed our efforts to do charter schools in the district. And, you know, the unions are probably second or first, I'd say the trial lawyers and the unions are the two most powerful entities in New York State, and they've only gotten more poor. So people are very fearful of them, electeds, and they undermine the ability to look, you know, we have waiting lists in almost every charter school. So, you know, that's what families want, and they're being denied it often.
You know, it's interesting what you cite there. And the other, I think, sad statistic for us in New York State is the number of people that out-migrate. They move out of New York State for various reasons. Among those reasons are just what you're talking about here, the lock that appears to be on the school systems all across the state that don't allow the kind of flexibility that you're going to see in states where there's lower taxes and, frankly, greater involvement of people such as yourself that really dig in and try to create a system that really is for the benefit of the students. I don't know how that changes in New York State.
Yeah, I'm disappointed that that has not been addressed at the state level. I think we lead the nation. Either we are one or two as far as out migration. So, you know, somebody had said to me, "Are you concerned with the redistricting that you might, you know, people were saying you might lose your seat because there's no more 27th." I said, "Look, you know, yeah, sure, but we should be more bothered by the fact we just lost another congressional seat. And why did we lose another congressional seat? Because we lost population in other states. And then we have less clout to advocate for our needs. And we've lost an immense amount of seats over the last five decades. And that's going to continue to happen unless we change our ways. But we're not. We are spending more. We're looking at tax more. And when you talk about the unions, with what we get out of our schools, we pay so much. And it's not just education, it's everything. So we really need a paradigm shift to make our region prosper again, to grow again. Now, you know, Buffalo is comparatively to other areas that I represent in the 27th Congressional District is doing great. But the amount of depopulation in the outlying counties that I represented is at a crisis level. And it just doesn't seem like anybody is ringing the bell up in Albany and say, we are in a crisis and we need to do things differently. They're doing things exactly the same as they have for the last four decades.
We were talking during the break about kind of political movements and what functionally happens. And historically, what functionally happens in this country is that the polar opposites find a way to moderate, and somehow the byproduct of the polar opposites is some kind of moderation. Something gets done. We seem to be at a point, not just in New York State, but really across the whole country, where the polar opposites are locked, and they're not finding that middle ground. And as a result, all the things that you suggest in terms of systemic fundamental issues here seem to be perpetuating themselves. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you break that. I don't know. Historically, again, if you look at political movements, what would break that is something truly radical that's so far out there that somehow it's mitigated to a point that really produces some change. We see that on the left. And the last thing I want to ask you about, we see that in one part of our culture right now, which with regard to energy, for example, mm-hmm. and the whole climate issue. And that really is now a worldwide movement. Right here in New York State, we have a vestige of that. Yeah. That is really, we had a show on it last week and a couple of shows in the previous several weeks about this regulation that's coming in about the use of natural gas. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
I think this is an existential issue for our region. The proposal, or it's actually far beyond just a proposal, to mandate that all new homes constructed in 2025, just in 2 years, cannot use natural gas. They have to use electric. And then after 2030, all homes. And then the same for commercial buildings. Now, this is, you know, electricity is about three times the cost. To convert your home is $30,000 to $50,000. So it's going to be an immense cost, again, on the middle and lower income people. But also, so that's an affordability issue. It's also a reliability issue. We do not have the electricity, and no one has proven that that's attainable right now to get to that point. And I'll just say, on a real estate side, if one of your realtors in 2029 is trying to sell a property, I'm looking to buy it, and it's 2029, and I say, well, it's a nice house, I like it. The furnace is 10 years old, it could last another 10 years, but it could kick in next year. And if it does, by this law, I will have to convert this whole house to electric. That's going to be about $50,000. So I'm going to lop a good chunk of what I was going to offer you off. So how is that going to impact this market around on the state? So there are huge issues, and this unelected body is proposing them. And unfortunately, you know, we for the first time in 100 years have a governor from Western New York who seems to be just going along with this. And this is going to be incredibly damaging to the state, but our region, and it's not going to change the needle at all on CO2 emissions. We're already the leader in the country. I think we have the lowest CO2 emissions in the country. If we went to zero, we would have a 0.00001% change in CO2 emissions, and China just opens up a couple more coal-fired plants, and it's over. So, you know, we have made major progress. We will continue to do it, but we need to do it in a responsible way. People need to be vocal on this, because this is going to be in the governor's budget next week, I believe. We need to get word to every legislator and the governor, tap the brakes on this. This is irresponsible governance.
Well, we've struck an accord. We've got 10 texts here that we're never going to get to, and we've got two callers we're not going to get to, and I apologize for that. But I just have one question for you to end this, and that is, it has to do with the law of unintended consequences. And I just wonder, in the debate that you saw in the state Senate and then in Congress, how far do you see the legislators at all levels really thinking through, just like you're saying with these gas regulations, natural gas regulations, do they really think through all the possible consequences?
Well,
just like you said,
the sale
of a house in 2029.
Right. No, I think that, climate issues have become an ideology or even a religion. And you just blindly say that. I was at the Senate when we voted on this bill, and we kept asking these questions. And they were like, oh, innovation will provide. We'll innovate it. Well, you know, that's not a responsible when you're talking about, we just had a storm where people died because they didn't have heat in their homes. 90% of our homes are natural gas fired here. Imagine if they were all electric at this point in time, how many people would have perished? And yet we're continued to go. Wouldn't we learn from this and kind of tap the brakes? And we're not. And our governor is not, who's from here, is from Hamburg. So we just need to be more vocal and do everything we can.
Chris Jacobs, just as a final word, if our listeners wanted to get in touch with you just to follow up, how would they do that?
Phone number at 716-852-0733.
Chris Jacobs, you've been a great public servant to us here in Western New York at various levels, and I hope to get you back on the show to talk about the afterlife, getting out of politics. We hardly got to that today, but thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks so much.
I'd like to thank our listeners. We'll be back again next week at the same time, and remember, when it comes to real estate, all of upstate is hunt country.
WBEN Buffalo, WKSE 3, HD3 Niagara Falls.
Always live on the free Odyssey app.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.